Chronic pain, it's a pain that lasts longer than 3 months, affects one in five Australians, and is recognised as our third largest health problem. And for people with this condition, it can mean a frustrating round of medical specialists trying to find effective treatments, and too often daily life becomes all too hard. An American specialist in pain management believes that doctors need to pay close attention to a patient's life story to work out the best individual treatment. And he's here to speak this week at a conference. So I welcome Emeritus Professor David Morris. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And David's here to speak this week, and we'll talk about the text of his speech. And also with me is Renee Goossens and Kimberly Brighton, who both have experienced years of chronic pain. So, David, you're a remarkable sort of a person. You're at the University of Virginia, and you have joint positions in both English and the medical faculties.
I'm a classic hybrid, slash writer-scholar, English medicine.
A Renaissance man. So is this how you came to come up with the idea of narrative pain treatment? Can you tell us what you mean about that?
Well, there is in Columbia University Medical School, physician Rita Sharon, who has a program in narrative medicine. And she makes a very good case that medical education should involve physicians learning what she calls narrative competence. That is how you go about understanding stories, what stories can offer to you, and arguing in effect that this is an area that is excluded from traditional medical education and needs to be brought into medical education. She doesn't deal specifically with pain, but she has spoken about it, and there are ways in which I think attending to what patients have to say with an attention to the narrative, as opposed to simply teasing out symptoms, can be very effective.
There's always a clear reason, or is there, why someone has chronic pain? I mean, why does pain continue in some people after a physical trauma but not in others?
These are mysteries. In fact, medicine is very good at dealing with acute pain, but not particularly good at dealing with chronic pain, and often there is no lesion that you can discover. There's no inflammation that you can treat, but the pain is there.
Mm. And I mentioned that must make sufferers feel incredibly frustrated and isolated, obviously, not being able to explain why it's happening.
Well, not only that, but the report from many pain patients, and I can out myself now that I've had chronic low back pain for 25 years, is that they often have the experience of not only isolation, but of being actually disbelieved, both by primary care physicians and even family and friends. If you can't see an injury, you can't see a lesion, you may easily be disbelieved.
It is one of those conditions I was mentioning earlier that there is no way on earth to fight your way into an understanding as someone who doesn't have it, is there?
I don't think there is. And, you know, Kimberly and Renee are people who could tell you from the inside what it's like. But if you haven't been there, it's hard to know what it's like to wake up every morning with a pain that's as familiar as your name.
Mm. As familiar as your name. Narrative therapy, tell us a little bit more about that. I mean, how could that change the way treatment was offered?
Well, there's a subspecialty in pain medicine that deals with what they call pain beliefs. And some of those beliefs involve control. Some involve what's called catastrophizing, that is feeling that the world is about to fall apart. Some of them involve feelings that you are disabled. Mm. So it's very clear. There's good research showing that certain kinds of beliefs affect both the pain intensity and also the possibilities of treatment. Now, what I'm thinking is that there are ways of talking about pain beliefs that go way beyond those sort of three major conditions that pain medicine focuses on.
Yeah, when you say that, of course, that doesn't lead, you know, to the point where a lot of people might just say to a person suffering chronic pain, oh, it's psychosomatic, it's all in your head.
Well, I wrote a chapter called Pain is Always in Your Head. I mean, it can't be anyplace else. Mm. Yes, there may be a lesion on your elbow, but and there may be a biochemical process that's going on at the site of injury, but it's all being processed in the brain. Mm. And that seems to me the breakthrough that pain medicine has made recently, that is they're really concerned now with what's happening in the brain of people who are in pain. And one of the things we know is that what happens in the brain of chronic pain patients is measurably different than what happens in the brain of acute pain patients.
And how much is that tied up with, you know, what the original trauma might be? I mean, that's what we're talking about with the narrative, isn't it? The narrative approach.
Well, the trauma may have a lot to do with how you feel about what's happening. There was one example I remember, a woman whose life revolved around playing the organ for her church every Sunday. And when her fingers were crippled with chronic pain, it was not only that she couldn't play the organ any longer, but something fundamental had dropped out of her life. It really affected her identity as much as it involved her avocation. And when pain affects identity, something major has happened.
Mm. I have with me Renee and Kimberly, who have been nodding vigorously all the way through this. Let's go to you first, Renee Goossens. Renee, this is an extraordinary thing. You've been living with chronic pain now for 50 years. Can you tell us what happened?
I was in a car accident, Wendy, kind of a weird one, in which my husband fell asleep at the wheel. He hadn't been drinking, he was just tired. And you know those lovely little English lanes with hedges on both sides? Mm. I screamed, stop. He put his foot on the accelerator instead of the brake, and we went flying, apparently. I don't know, because I was subsequently in a coma for 3.5 weeks, but we went flying into a field, and the car overturned 3 times, but then it decided it would run over me. So I was actually run over by the car, and I was under it for 4 hours. During that time, it did substantial internal damage to organs and neck, and stuck my neck through to my trunk, and I'm just about to have my 23rd operation to my neck in the last 10 years. Things have developed very well now, however. Good news for pain sufferers is that there is now a development based on what's called a TENS machine, which people will be familiar with, transcutaneous nerve stimulator, mm-hmm. that people sometimes wear externally. Now they're going to put a little USB-sized plug at the back of my skull, and that will talk to the pain and say, no, 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 you haven't got pain, and it'll be wired up with a little battery in my chest about the same size as a 50-cent piece, and that's a great improvement on the one I had in France in 1994 for my back pain. Because the whole body's a bit of a mess. But the great thing, Wendy, is that the doctors told me I'd never walk again. Now, I was very lucky for 20 years. When I came out of hospital after 2 years, you know, National Health was sort of not terribly good at moving people on in those days. So from 21 to 23, I was in hospital, deprived of the pleasure of seeing my gorgeous 7-month-old baby, because children under 12 were not allowed into the wards. Mm.
Two years you didn't see your child.
I finally got home, and, you know, lovely family pictures. Won't it be wonderful to see my husband and baby? My husband had been visiting me regularly, I might add. Come home, that wonderful moment, and, you know, everyone will relate to this. Darling, I've got something terrible to tell you. We all know what's going to come. But I didn't know what was coming next, and that was, and my girlfriend is expecting our baby in 3 months. Mm. So I went completely quiet, which is what you do at 23. And then after about a minute's break, I pointed to the door and said, keep walking. Mm. And I realised that I'd better throw out all my meds, learn to walk, and I learned to walk by crawling and by using my son's pushchair as a walking frame. Mm. And I was lucky. I trained as a teacher, came back to Australia, which was the aim. And I had to get back to what I used to love doing. before I couldn't walk and all those things. And I've been lucky because I was musically trained. I've been able to still work with aspiring young opera singers. I've learnt how to retrieve an awful lot of my previously lost life, even in my 70s. And also, I think volunteering is something that I would recommend to anybody else. I do all this voluntarily because if we're not able to work more than 9 hours a week, which is what my doctors have said, we really aren't able to be employed. It would be a very understanding boss when you could ring up and say, sorry, my migraine is so bad this morning, I just cannot possibly come to work. But if you're a volunteer and you've explained that, you know, there will be occasions when you can't deliver the goods. That's what you have to do. So the other few little tricks I've learned is brighten things up by wearing bright colours, give yourself some confidence that way, smile, sit or stand up straight, that gives your body a sense of being positive, really concentrate on others, not on self. And the fact I had a baby to bring up at 2.5, from whom I'd been parted for so long, it was such a wonderful treasure, and I didn't have any ability to think of myself. So right from the beginning, because I had Philip, I was able to think of him and only really of him, and I had to learn to walk for him, and that was all a reason. And the other, perhaps, I wrote a book on pain management, which took me 6 years of research, interviewing 100 people in 3 countries, and my aim was to find out how do people cope with chronic pain internationally, France, England and Australia. And it's all the same way. It's all by little tricks of the mind, like avoiding negative people. It's don't talk about your condition with people you don't know or trust. They'll only, you know, be talking about you in the background.
And these are all little things that you've learned, you know, aside from drugs. I'd like to go to Kimberly, if I may. Kimberly, you are 36 years old and you were nodding away there. You were in a serious car accident and you were nodding away when you were talking about that you're disbelieved, your pain is disbelieved, that you lose your identity. Can you tell us about a couple of those aspects?
Yeah, I think that's really important that people who are in the system, I suppose it's a compensation system a lot of people find themselves in after a car accident. And I was disbelieved by the whole system and the medical practitioners. And I was young at the time, I was 19 years old, and it's really hard to know what to do and where to go and how to get out of.
Did everybody around you, I mean, I know that there's a, you think, David, that, or I don't know if this is your comment, but a doctor's comment that, you know, this is almost like chronic pain is like leprosy. There's a lot of stigma about it. He said, well, like leprosy was in the old days. Were you surrounded by people, Kimberly, who just said, oh, for goodness sake, just get better. When are you going to get better?
Basically, yes, because as David indicated, there's not always a lot of pathology to explain the experience of pain, and my pain was disabling me, and people were saying to me, well, there's nothing wrong with you. You need to get back into it, keep going. But at the same time, I was completely disabled by pain. I was waking up every morning with pain, neck, back.
Are you in pain now?
I am not as severe because I've learnt to manage my pain, and I think that's a really important message to get out to people in pain, that you can learn to manage your pain, life does become better, and that you're not the only one out there. So things such as National Pain Week and the Pain Festival that's on Saturday is really important for people to go to so they can see that there are many people out there in pain and you're not the only one. And it's actually really real. What you're feeling is real.
Yeah. We're listening to Renee there. She says she's got various tricks there. She's wearing bright colours today. She's beautifully made up. Her hair's done. She's looking bright and sparky. And she says she avoids negative people. She's got an arsenal of techniques there. What are some of yours?
I suppose one thing for me was learning about pain. What is pain and how it actually affects your body. And that knowledge to me is power, and once I understood pain, I could then actually move forward to manage my pain. And for me, it's really important to be active and remain active, so walking. And I also eventually, after a long period of time, got back to the gym, and I did play netball as well. It mm-hmm. took a long time for me to do those activities. So doing things you enjoy, and I agree with what Renee said, not focusing on yourself all the time. Mm-hmm. I was also told I'd never have babies, and I now have a 4-year-old and a 10-month-old. Mm. So just enjoying life,
yeah.
but also integrating the pain management as part of your life, because mm. now it's something that I do every day. The way I think and the activities that I undertake is all about managing
you're,
pain.
You're very emotional talking about this morning, aren't you?
Yeah, I am.
Yes, because it's two remarkable women, David.
Absolutely. And listening to Kimberly and to Renee, it'd be hard for me to say to someone, well, you could understand their pain very well without understanding their story.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the story is so wrapped up with the pain that not to pay attention to the story seems to be to miss something really fundamental about their experience. And there was a book that's come out recently called Relieving Pain in America. It was put together by a blue ribbon panel of pain specialists. And if I could just read to you their first finding, it says, pain care must be tailored to each person's experience. And when I read that, I thought, well, yeah.
Duh.
How long has that taken? Yeah. But in some sense, there's a little revolution going on there, mm-hmm. and medical revolutions tend to be very quiet. But to say that it has to be tailored to each person's experience mm. as opposed to disease or pathology is a real leap, I think, for pain medicine to make. And this is a blue ribbon panel in the U.S. Mm. In 2011 coming out as their main finding about patient care. Mm-hmm.
So you've got these two women here who have done remarkable things with your lives, and what you're saying is that you'd like to see more of the medical profession partner with women like these.
I think so. Yeah. I think so. And a lot of what we know about pain comes from experiments that are done on healthy volunteers or people who have put themselves inside the medical system and are pain patients. There are a lot of people who live now outside the medical system with chronic pain and do so by their own terms successfully. What do they have to teach us? Mm. Something that we need to know. And also, I think we need to share these little tricks. I had a 20-hour plane ride. I bought myself a weightlifter's belt before I got on the plane. It's a lot of lumbar support for weightlifters, and it was terrific. It got me here in good shape.
There you go. Well, thank you very much for joining us this morning, all of you, and good luck with your speech. Pain Management Specialist Emeritus. I'm having one of those mornings. Emeritus Professor David Morris, chronic pain sufferers. And I wouldn't like to define you by this, I should say, ladies. Renee Goossens and Kimberly Broughton, thank you so much. For more information about support and activities during this week, National Pain Week, there's a link on our website to the Chronic Pain Association. Thank you, all of you, for coming in this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you, Wendy.
Thanks, Wendy.